two faces of the story, and one has to do with QCD, and it's four-dimensional QCD, non-supersymmetric one, pure fluid dynamics, and I will talk about n equals 3. And another part of the story has to do with gravity, which is two-dimensional gravity and integrable theory of gravity. So for me, at least one of the most interesting lessons from this work was that such a thing as integrable theory of gravity exists. So, but today I will focus mostly on the first part of the story, which what we are doing recently. And I guess Rafael's talk was more on the second part, but actually he covered everything. But I'll go in more detail about lattice part of the story. So well, as you can see, there is a motivation to do this because there is data. So I should warn also that during this talk, for me, data means lattice data. So it's not like you're not colliding actual particles. You're doing simulations on the computer. But this is lattice data for, well, it will be n equals 3 glue dynamics in four dimensions. And well, there is also some theory predictions here. So in the first part of my talk, I will just spend some time explaining, telling you more about what is this data here and what is this theory. And actually, it's called, in this plot, it's called Nambu-Goto predictions. I think that's really the wrong name. But we'll see. So what is being measured? Well, on the lattice, you calculate the Euclidean partition function for glue dynamics. And well, on the lattice, all dimensions are compact. But here you think you should think about is one dimension being more compact than the other. So physically, you want to imagine like really compactifying four-dimensional theory on a circle. Then what you can do, you have a new sector in your theory, which comes from, well, you think it's essentially like Wilson line or Polyakov loop. You know, people call it different names, but it's the same. So you take a Wilson line, you wrap it around a compact dimension, and then you calculate a partition function with two of these operators inserted at different positions. And it's useful to think about this direction, which separates them as a time direction. Now, the point is that, so you may think about this wrapping operators, like it's operator creating some state in your theory. The point is that this sector with non-trivial windings, it's orthogonal to the sector of the theory without windings, because when you are on the lattice with compact dimension, with periodic dimension, then there is a global symmetry, which is called center symmetry. So essentially, it consists of gauge transformations with twisted boundary conditions. So it's really part of the global group. And this winding states, they're charged under this symmetry, while usual states which live in the bulk, like glue balls, they're not charged under this symmetry. So this two-point for this correlator, it's there should necessarily be, when you insert unity here, there should be necessarily be states with windings in the middle, at least when the size of the circle is large enough, because when it shrinks and becomes small, that the center symmetry becomes spontaneously broken, which corresponds to the confinement transition. But we'll be always in the regime when the radius is large enough, so that center symmetry is not broken. And then what you do, you study partition function in this sector, and then as usual on the lattice, so if you take the limit of large time separation between these two operators, that allows to determine the energy spectrum in the sector. In other words, the energy spectrum of string excitations. So the way to think about it, so if you go, you take low energy effective field theory for this sector, of course, there are states which live in the bulk, which you can add on top of this loop there. But there is a gap separating them. So glue ball has a finite mass. So below the mass of the glue ball, the theory consists of just excitations of the string. And there is some set of excitations which is guaranteed to be there, which are just like wiggles on the string, which are Goldstones, which live on Goldstone bosons, which propagates along the string. And so you measure spectrum of these excitations. And so for ground state, to measure the ground state, you just introduce the straight Polyakov loop. But then there are, for excited states, so you introduce some wiggled lines. And this is one of my favorite formulas from this lattice papers, which are doing that. So they literally introduce operators which like certain shapes just to match quantum numbers of different excitations which may live on the string. And if you have a large enough basis of operators, you can probe excited states of the string. So this is the calculation being done, and this is the data which I will be showing. So if there is any question about data, like what is being measured, that's a good point to ask it now. So let me tell you a bit more about this data, if it's clear what's going on. So there are several puzzles here. Well, first of all, well, there is remarkable agreement with a theory. So I'll tell more later what is a theory. So what's shown here, this is the data for ground state. So this is a just straight string wrapping around this compact dimension. And these dots are theory predictions. And it's really remarkable because, well, the point here, so on the horizontal axis, what I've shown here is the length of the string in the units of string tension. So somewhere around 1.4 here, that's the point when center symmetry gets broken. So this, it's really, it tells you what is the width of the string, because it's not fundamental string, it's QCD flux tube. So there is a finite width to this thing. So really, like these data points correspond to not it's not a long string, it's really like a blob which is twice larger than its width. So it's very surprising to see that there is a theory which accurately predicts what's going on here, because at the end we're talking about actual like QCD, which is strongly coupled theory. So it's very surprising to see that there is some theoretical prediction which works so well for these blobby strings. Well, puzzle number two is that actually this theory is known to be wrong. So what's shown on this plot, so this is again the ground state energy, and these are another couple of states. This state corresponds to adding a single phonon propagating along the string. So this is, it's one phonon, these are two phonons, but both of them are left movers. So you add to the string just purely left moving particles propagating on its wall sheet. And what's shown on the by solid lines, that's honest effective field theory calculation. So I'll tell more how it's being done, but really theory prediction, at least before, used to be these solid lines here. And clearly they start deviating from data at for short enough strings, which is not a surprise. You expect effective field theory to break down for short strings. What is surprising is that still there is what's called theory prediction, but this theory, these dotted lines here, what you do here, you take a bosonic string and you do light cone quantization for this bosonic string, and then you plug in the answer d equal to 4, and that's the resulting spectrum shown by these dotted lines here. But we know that's not the right thing to do for QCD string, because light cone quantization produces four-dimensional relativistic theory only, well, it doesn't produce four-dimensional relativistic theory. It's only at d equal 26 that it produces relativistic theory from target space point of view. Clearly something interesting going on here. Somehow wrong theory works much better than the standard perturbative expansion, and that's another puzzle to understand. And finally, life is more interesting for other levels. So what is shown here, so it's the same plot, but now I can see the two particle states with, here it's with two phonons, but the difference with the previous plot is that one of them is left moving and another is right moving. So here really some action is going on. You have two phonons colliding on a string. By different colors, I've shown here the energy levels for different states. So you may organize states in the multiplets of the O2 symmetry, which rotates around the string. These green points, they correspond to symmetric tensor with respect to O2. This is a scalar, and this is a antisymmetric, this pseudoscalar or antisymmetric tensor. But in 402, it's the same as just pseudoscalar. So you see these levels are badly splitted from each other. Now the green and blue line, these are again, these are standard effective field theory prediction, which not surprisingly, you do to do this calculation, you do expansion in LS over R, where R is the length of the string. So the most straightforward naive expansion gives for you these blue and green lines, and for blue and red would be the same. So for scalar and pseudoscalar, one finds it at leading node. I'll tell more about that, but at leading node, they don't split from each other. Well, and you see that for these states, really, these lines are totally useless. So there is really practically no overlap between the regime when there is data and between this conventional field theory, effective field theory expansion. So it's, well, one may say it, maybe it works for these two points, but we'll see later that that's not the case, actually. It's, well, we'll see. So also, I should say, OK, there is a splitting between these two green points. These are splittings between states in the symmetric tensor multiplet, which well, like between different polarizations of symmetric tensor multiplets. And this one shouldn't really be there. So it's just impossible in the continuum. So that tells you that there are some lattice effects here. And that tells you roughly the systematic uncertainty related to this lattice effect. So the splitting between green points is a lattice artifact. Okay, so these are the three puzzles. And well, I'll try to convince you that there is a coherent picture which allows to understand what's going on here. So let me start with a first brief review of what kind of calculation is being done and what is the theory we're talking about. So as I already said, so the way to think, at least from effective field theory perspective, the way to think about the situation is that first you want to construct the theory for infinitely long string. This is just a system of Goldstone bosons which realize this coset. So this is the target space Poincaré group, which is broken to the product of transverse rotations around the string and of the two-dimensional Poincaré group along the wall sheet. So you want to write the theory of Goldstones, which are wiggles on the string. So there are d minus two physical modes here. And this coset implies that there should be also non-linearized full Poincaré symmetry acting on these transverse excitations. And then, well, you construct this theory in infinite volume, and then you compactify this theory. And so you're looking for finite volume spectrum of that Goldstone theory. So that's effective field theory's view of what's going on. And well, there is a rather standard construction which allows to achieve this. So it's, I call it like CCVZ construction too, because it's similar to a construction of the pi and Lagrange. And it's not really CCVZ. It was done by different people a bit later. But it has the same spirit. So the convenient way to organize the action is the following. So you construct this object X mu, which like it has d minus two components, which are physical perturbations, the transverse Goldstones. And then you combine them together with the coordinates on the wall sheet into the d-dimensional vector, Poincaré vector. And then so this X mu that what describes the embedding of the string full sheet in the target space. And then you just write set of geometric invariants constructed of corresponding to this embedding. So there is a Nambu-Goto term, which would be just the square root of determinant of the induced metric constructed here. And then there is rigidity term. So K here is the extrinsic curvature of the surface. Etc. So of course, well, it's a bit perverse way to describe this. Usually in string theory, one prefers to start with X mu's being dynamical degrees of freedom, all of them. And then you can reconstruct this description by taking the gauge X0 equal tau and X1 equals sigma, which would be static gauge. It's a convenient gauge to talk about long strings. But Aaron Torpers started with this more perverse description and awkward description. Just because in this description, it's clear, it's manifest that there is always, in any number of dimensions, there will be d minus two physical degrees of freedom here. So the theory will be perturbatively unitary. But of course, it will be non-renormalizable because of this, well, there are derivative interactions here. So in particular, when you expand square root, so from Nambu-Goto term, you find free kinetic term dx squared. But then there are terms like dx to the 4 with different index contractions. And these coefficients in front of this quartic coupling, they are fixed by non-linearized Lorentz symmetries, or they just or whatever you get from expanding the square root. So clearly, this is interacting theory. And it's non-renormalizable theory, which is not a big deal here because, well, we're trying to find a effective field theory description for, not for fundamental strings, but for like thick flux tubes. And then what one does, so in this effective field theory, one puts it on a finite volume and calculates. The standard calculation is just to calculate the finite volume spectrum using LS over R expansion. So that's what the solid lines, which I was showing you before, that corresponds to that show the result of this calculation. So actually related, the original question which got us interested into this whole business and which is related at the end to what I will be doing, but I think it's amusing on its own. So, well, in this language, if I'm an effective field theorist, I know nothing about fundamental strings. Well, when will be the first place when I notice that when I have, when d equals 26, when I have 24 flavors in this non-normalizable theory, that something interesting happens? And what exactly happens? And well, the project of the answer is, well, somehow in some sense, the theory should be renormalizable because we know there is a way to quantize it in critical number of dimensions in such a way that they describe microscopic strings, fundamental strings. But we'll see that actually the actual answer is more subtle and more interesting. So what about these dotted lines which I was showing on the plot? So that's like what's called theory prediction in the lattice community. And theory prediction is the following. So as I said, you take fundamental strings, that you take this number of quota action, but instead of perturbatively expanding and working in the static gauge, instead you go to light cone gauge. And in light cone gauge, you can solve this theory, you can quantize it, and you get, well, this spectrum. At any number of space-time dimension, you get this. But you know that this is a spectrum of relativistic target space theory only at d equal 26. However, you can still plot the spectrum, and that's what these dotted lines were showing before. So it's spectrum, we'll see later on, it's a spectrum of some two-dimensional theory, but it's not a spectrum of Lorentz invariant, like four-dimensional theory. So given that, I think it's better not to call it Nambu-Gotha spectrum, because for me, Nambu-Gotha is relativistic theory in the target space point of view. I will call it either light cone or GGRT theory, because, well, it's essentially these guys who did this calculation back in early 70s, but you need to add winding to what they did, but otherwise it's the same calculation. Critical property of this theory, crucial property of this theory, which one can see right away, is that there are no splittings between different SOD minus 2 multiplets. So there is unbroken symmetry here. As I said, the transverse rotations around the string. So particles come in the multiplets symmetry. Spectrum depends only on this NNL tilde, which is which counts this like what's called in string theory level of the state, but really it's just the KK, the total, like the NNL tilde, they count the total left moving and right moving KK momentum in this compactified theory. So that's I think for phenomenologists that's conventional language. And so the fact that the spectrum depends only on the total KK momentum, that tells us that there is no splittings between SOD minus 2 multiplets. Coming back to the question, so how would we see, if we do static gauge calculation, how would we see that something special happens at d equal 26? Let's just start doing calculations. Let's start calculating what effective field theorists usually calculate. And the natural object to calculate, let's just calculate scattering of these phonons. So I consider now infinitely long string. I take two phonons and they scatter one from another. And well, this is the general SOD minus 2 invariant amplitude. And there are three terms here, but well, this first term will be important in what follows. So this is called annihilation. So this term corresponds to situation when you start with two phonons which say correspond to string oscillating in one plane, you collide them, and then string starts oscillating in the transverse plane. So when this term is there, it indicates that such processes are allowed. And now if you calculate for Nambu-Goto action, if you calculate this amplitude at the tree level, so there are two vertices, which I've shown you before. There are two dx to the four vertices with different tensor structure. And you find that for Nambu-Goto choice, the coefficients in front of these vertices, they take such a form that there is no annihilation. So classically, if you take a relativistic string, and if it's if it oscillates in one plane, it will keep oscillating in that plane forever. And that, of course, that property is related to the property of that there is no splittings between different SOD minus two multiplets. So actually, it's more or less it's one and the same thing. Well, let's keep going. Let's now calculate the amplitude in the theory at one loop. And at one loop, what one finds, well, there is some part which is just fixed by unitarity. So with this three-level amplitude, there is part which you can restore by unitarity, and you find it there. It's not very interesting. But now you find that there is an annihilation term. So this property, if you like, well, important thing here is to do calculations with regularization which preserve non-linearized Lorentz symmetry. So well, we used dimensional regularization here. So that we're really talking about relativistic strings, then you find that this property, which was there at the classical level, and which ensures at the end of the day the absence of splitting between different multiplets, is broken at the one loop level, and it's broken with the coefficient proportional to d minus 26. So that's the first place where like naive effective field theorists would see that something interesting going on at 26 dimensions, that this property, which is absence of annihilations, is no longer there at any number of dimensions. And actually, well, this calculation on its own is more or less enough to explain what happens with ground state, why ground state is predicted so well by the theory. So note that even though this term, well, it's of course there, but it came from one loop, but it's polynomial in the kinematic invariant. So that means you can subtract this term from the amplitude by local counter term to your action, which would violate non-linearized Lorentz symmetry, but otherwise it would be like allowed counter term to add if you just care about two-dimensional Lorentz invariants. So that means that actually, well, if you work in the derivative expansion, the first correction which distinguishes the Lagrangian of QCD string, which for me is a real Lorentz invariant theory in four-dimensional sense, and the Lagrangian of that theory which gives rise to GGRT spectrum, to the square root spectrum. So at the level of the Lagrangian, the first correction is correspond to this operator. So this is a local operator which would at three level produce the same annihilation term in the amplitude. So that means if you're in derivative expansion, if you are now comparing the finite volume spectrum of the two theories, the first difference would come from inclusion of this operator perturbatively, and that corresponds to this operator gives rise to 1 over r to the 5 splitting between different SOD minus 2 multiplets. Yeah.
You said that breaks the nonlinear Lorentz?
Yeah, this counter term it breaks nonlinear realized Lorentz symmetry.
How did you generate that if you use the Lorentz invariant with regulation?
No, you're not generating it. So, Lorentz invariant theory doesn't have that, but if you just look at the at the level of S matrix, you look at the difference between relativistic theory and that Lorentz Lyapunov quantized theory, that then you can add to Lagrangian, of relativistic theory this counter term, and so that to cancel that one loop effect. So it's really, so this theory is not relativistic. So yeah, you don't generate it. So, but that's just a trick to calculate. So what I'm saying, you can really, if you do in 1 over r to the, less over r expansion, and if you are lazy to calculate stuff, you can say, oh, I know exact spectrum for this theory. In particular, I can expand this spectrum in 1 over r expansion. And I know that the first correction for relativistic string would come from this term, which corresponds to 1 over r to the 5 splittings. So in particular, this solid and green line here, that's, so this dashed line is what corresponds to exact spectrum of this Lyapunov quantized theory, but this solid and green line, that what corresponds to the correction coming from this term. So that's a fast way to prove that actually, just as a consequence of nonlinearized Lorentz symmetry, in LS of R expansion, all the terms in the spectrum of relativistic string up to 1 R to the fifth, including, they're universal. So they're just fixed by requirement of nonlinearized Lorentz symmetry. And that's universality on its own actually is enough to explain the result for ground state data. First of all, for ground state data, it turns out that this term doesn't contribute. It has zero vacuum expectation value. So there is no, even at the 1 over R to the fifth level, there is no correction to ground state energy. Well, and you can't really see it. But what I've shown here, I've shown like there are two lines here. Solid line is the exact square root, and the dashed line is the ground state energy which you would get in LS of R expansion, including terms up to R to the fifth. So somehow for ground state, it's, well, it's a power of Taylor expansion. So it turns out the Taylor expansion works very nicely, and there is no miracle here. You really, and this, even for strings as short and dead, just the universality which is there as a consequence of nonlinearized Lorentz symmetry is enough to explain why data fits the theory so well. Well, however, clearly, we need to work harder for excited states. So here again, this solid lines that shows there this LS of R expansion, including all the universal terms. And clearly, they start deviating from data for short strings, which, as I said, is not a surprise on its own. However, what is a surprise that the data points still keep following the spectrum of light cone quantized string. So we need some, that's clear call, clear indication that we need to find some other expansion to explain what's going on for these other states. And to understand the origin of the problem, why this expansion breaks down so badly, actually, it's useful just to look at the, and why it works nicely for square root, it's useful to look at the spectrum of light cone quantized theory and to see what's going on. Well, what's going on? So for light cone, for ground state, you have NNL tilde equal to 0. So you're just expanding this square root of R squared LS to the 4 minus this D minus 2 term. However, for excited states, well, you have these extra terms under square root proportional to the number of excitations, but also they're proportional to these factors 4 pi and 4 pi squared. Well, and the problem is that 2 pi is a large number. So at the numerological level, just expansion of this square root becomes badly behaving asymptotic expansion, not when LS over R is of order 1, but when 2 pi LS over R is of order 1. So even if we didn't talk about relativistic string and we just wanted to calculate the spectrum of light cone quantized theory, still this naive LS over R expansion is not very useful if you want to do better than to talk about distances shorter than 2 pi over LS. So, well, to make this numerological observation something more useful, so let's reformulate what's going on in more physical terms. Well, we know where 2 pi over R coming from. So really, the way physical way to think about excited state of a long string with number of phonons on them is that, well, really there are two different kind of parameters here. The energy depends, well, on one hand side, it depends really like on the LS of R, but also it depends on the moment of the phonons. So there are two physically different parameters, the moment of the excitations and, well, really the length of the string, or the string width of the length of the width. And these 2 pi over R, they come in from here. They're coming from the fact that if you consider free particles in a finite volume, their momenta are for the 2 pi over R. So if you plug in this expression, this 2 pi over R here, and then expand an LS over R, then somehow you lose the fact that physically, to start with, this energy dependent on two different parameters. So the idea is to try to improve on this expansion by finding a way to calculate finite volume spectrum, which somehow keep explicit that you have these two different parameters and trying to disentangle. So roughly to disentangle terms which have 2 pi and which don't have 2 pi. And the natural language to talk about this is the following. So really, you want to think about calculating finite volume spectrum as a two-step procedure. So first, let's calculate S matrix for scatterings. We're doing already. So let's calculate S matrix for scattering of these phonons in the infinite volume. And the moment we did, and that really, that's what corresponds to PLS expansion. So S matrix doesn't know about LS over R, it just knows about PLS. So that would be PLS expansion. So you want to calculate infinite volume S matrix. And then you want to extract finite volume spectrum from the S matrix. Well, in principle, I think we all believe that for quantum field theory, S matrix have that information in it. So it should be possible to do. However, well, so that the first step is really standard perturbative expansion in PLS. So this second step, in principle, should be doable. However, in practice, it's hard. So it's known how to do it, well, at least in two cases. So one case, you do it perturbatively for massive series, and that's the standard practice for lattice people. That's what they always do. That's how they connect the finite volume energies which they measure with scattering amplitudes. And also you can do it exactly in integrable two-dimensional series through thermodynamic beta ansatz, which, well, these two techniques there, we'll see, I'll talk more about that, but they have lots in common. Well, of course, for the problem for us is that relativistic strings neither massive nor integrable, so that looks like a problem. However, we know that S matrix for the series at low energies approaches the S matrix of integrable theory. So what we'll be trying to do, we'll be trying to somehow organize perturbative expansion around that integrable theory to which the relativistic string asymptotes to for low momentum. So to see how it works and to get an idea what we're trying to do, first, well, it's good to switch, so it's already clear. So I want to organize all my discussion in terms of S matrix. So let's first switch. Let's do the inverse procedure. Let's switch for this GGRT theory. Let's switch the discussion from talking in terms of its finite volume spectrum. Instead, let's discuss what this theory is in terms of scattering amplitudes. So I showed to you the first perturbative first order calculations, but really, this reconstructing S matrix from finite volume spectrum, that's much simpler task than doing backwards. And well, there is again prescription due to Lusher, which says how to do that. Well, so basically the idea is very simple. So if you have exact energy of your two particle state, then you may think about it in two ways. So if you put your theory in a in finite volume and take the size of complexification large, then on one hand side, if you look at the time evolution of two particle state, then well, it evolves with the state, with the energy, with the phase, which whatever the energy of the state is. On the other hand, most of the time you may think about this two particle state is just a collection of two freely propagating particles, so this phase shift is just twice the energy of one particle state. Plus there is a phase shift, additional phase shift, which corresponds to like collisions between particles which they pass through each other, and that happens every delta t equal to r over 2. And this phase shift, that's by definition, that's what the infinite volume scattering phase is. So by writing the same phase shift in these two different ways, one finds that the scattering phase shift, it's proportional to the leading large volume asymptotics of the two particle binding energy. So it's very intuitive result. So if you apply this for GGRT spectrum, you find this nice answer. So you find that this phase shift is just exponent. It's e to the is. And this is two particle phase shifts. And then the theory is integrable. All what's going on in the light cone theory is that you have two phonons. They go through each other. And there is a phase shift required. So there is no particle production. You can see it again from the spectrum. If there were particle production, there would be splittings between different SOD minus 2 multiplets. So really, this S matrix completely determines this theory. In some way, you can think about this S matrix as a definition of the theory. It's interesting S matrix in many respects. So first of all, it has this essential singularity in the UV, which is usually considered to be a bad thing. However, in this particular case, on the physical sheet, it's still polynomially bounded. Actually, it's not only polynomially bounded, exponentially small on the physical sheet. On the physical sheet. So for imaginary part of S positive, there is a cut all the way from 0 to infinity because it's massless theory. And then along the imaginary axis, this phase shift actually exponentially small. And that's the only possibility to have some non-trivial function here in the exponent and to have exponentially bounded amplitude. So if you, for instance, add here something like S cube, which also would be consistent with analyticity and crossing, but however you lose this polynomial boundness. So it agrees with explicit three-level one-loop results. There is no poles anywhere, and there is a cut all the way to infinity, as I said, with infinite number of broad resonances. It's 1 minus cosine. Most important for what we'll be doing next is that, well, as I said, you can really think about this S matrix as a definition of the theory. In particular, you can reconstruct the entire string spectrum using thermodynamic beta ansatz if you start with this S matrix. So before explaining how it works, let me list a few properties of this theory, which I think are very interesting. But I don't have much time to talk about that, so Rafael will talk more about that in the fall. So, well, it's S matrix of UV complete two-dimensional theory, in the sense that you know the scattering amplitudes at all energies. And we used to think about UV complete theories as corresponding to RG flow between some fixed point in UV and fixed point in the IR. So this theory is not like that. There are many ways to see that there is no UV fixed point for this theory. In particular, well, one way to see it, you know that for two-dimensional conformal field theories, left movers and right movers, there is homomorphic factorization, so they don't really talk to each other. However, so that means that if there is a UV fixed point, that S matrix corresponding to scattering of left movers and right movers should go to one in the infinity. And this theory doesn't do that. And related to that, well, if you try to determine the UV central charge, which, for instance, you can do by looking at the short distance asymptotics of ground state energy in finite volume, which is usually the coefficient in front of 1 over r there, here you fail because it's the square root, and the square root at small enough radius, it just becomes imaginary, related to Hagedorn behavior of this theory at large temperatures. So there is a maximal Hagedorn temperature here. So furthermore, there is no local of shell observables in this theory. Even though there is analytic S matrix with like all the good properties, however, this essential singularity at the infinity, so there are masses in integrable two-dimensional series, which in principle allow to reconstruct from S matrix. Usually they allow to reconstruct finite volume, no, not finite volume, but just off-shell correlation functions. So these methods essentially correspond to applying LSE procedure backwards. And they give rise to, there is a number of recurrent relations which one writes and solves. For these methods to be applicable, you need not only your amplitudes not only to be polynomially bounded on the physical sheet, but really to be polynomially bounded. And this essential singularity at the infinity prevents one from reconstructing these local of shell observables. All these properties and some others, so that's what makes us to think that really this theory is more properly thought of as not quantum field theory, but integrable quantum theory of gravity. And this, well, we name this, call this new type of RG flow behavior asymptotic fragility, meaning that, well, the picture in mind that really you can't add any local perturbation to this flow without destroying the finiteness property. So to start with, you started with non-renormalizable theory, but somehow miraculously it produced finite on-shell amplitudes for you. But the moment you start calculating off-shell quantities, so that's perturbative technical way to see what goes wrong. So the moment you start calculating off-shell amplitudes, you see that theory behaves just any other non-renormalizable theory. So there are extra divergences, you know, like operators mixed with each other. There is infinite number of parameters, so you can work with this theory, but you can't really predict these off-shell amplitudes. Physically to think about this theory is to know that if you take just two bricks in four-dimensional gravity and scatter from each other at large value of impact parameter. So you use it, you use it the leading iconal scattering. So that would give rise correspond exactly to this e to the s phase shift. So really, this is the S matrix for scattering of gravitational shock waves, of relativistic gravitational shock waves. Of course, in two dimensions, like there is no impact parameter, but somehow theory is integrable, and so this iconal S matrix, which describes zero angle limit of scattering in like any theory of gravity in higher dimensions, here turns out to be exact S matrix for describing this two-dimensional relativistic theory. And related to that, there is a very classical way to see how this S matrix arises. So the physical one physical implication of this S matrix is that when you have two excitations and as they pass through each other, there is a phase, there is a time delay proportional to the energy of collision, and that you can calculate classically. So what's shown here is the following. So I'm considering the choke here. So I'm considering. I'm considering left moving king on a string. So it's just the exact solution of classical equation. And then I consider how it affects propagation of the right moving bump. And so what's shown here by these arrows, these are effective null directions in the effective metric which right moving bump feels in the presence of such a left moving king. And well, what happens, there are two effects. First of all, just physically, string is longer when you have this kink. But also, it's this kink, if it's large enough, if it's deep enough, you can see somehow it carries away the left moving guy. It carries away towards left for a while. Eventually, it makes it out. And you can calculate classical time delay associated with this process and exactly reproduce the time delay which you get from S matrix. So we're used in gravitational theories that many aspects of the scattering can be calculated semi-classically. Here, it's even classically, just for time delay, you get exactly the right answer. Of course, there is much more information in scattering amplitudes than just that, but that's also somehow the property which we're used to from gravitational theories.
This is the non-relativistic light cone.
No, here I'm just doing, this is just, I'm doing classical Nambu-Gotha. Just I'm solving classical equation for Nambu-Gotha theory in any number of dimensions. So, yeah, I'm looking at this
kind. But the previous result, the general one, this still is normalizable, but not the.
So that theory, it's at any number of dimensions. There is this family of integrable theories which exists for any number of flavors. And at d equal 26, that theory also happens to have non-linearized Lorentz symmetry. And by the way, the excellent question, which I don't know the answer to, is how to see directly from this S matrix. So I give you S matrix, which is e to the s, like times unit matrix in like space of 24 times 24 flavors. So how to see directly from that S matrix that exactly at the 24 flavors, there is non-linearized Lorentz symmetry, which acts in this theory, and I think it would be very amusing to do that calculation, but I don't know, just directly in terms of on-shell quantities.
Do you expect the existence of such a property that is normalizable but not going to a fixed point in the UV is special to two dimensions?
I don't know, really. I don't know how to systematically construct theories like that, and I don't know whether this property is special. So I think that's a very interesting question to understand. So what is the space of this series and how really to talk
it's
about
tied
that?
To integrability.
Huh?
It's not tied to integrability.
Well, I hope not. So, but maybe it is. I don't, because really, like many of the properties which this theory produces for us is what you want from gravity, right? For instance, this absence of local observables. So one may think that maybe this story is more general. And for instance, here, so it looks almost as a black hole, right? So this particle is kind of, it gets carried away, but then it there is this bump and it travels along a lot with this bump. And you would think if the theory were not integrable, that somehow this tiny perturbation that it would get lost into this big bump. So the only reason that it makes it out, essentially, is because the theory is integrable. So it's very interesting. For me, that's one of the most interesting questions about this whole business, is how to construct and whether these theories exist, whether they are non-integrable theories with this kind of UV behavior. But the problem to do that exactly this asymptotic fragility, that's essentially what prevents us from doing it. Because normally when you construct a theory, okay, then you perturb it, and you can perturbatively calculate what happens. But here, the moment we perturb it by some local operator, we lose this finiteness property. So I don't know a systematic way to answer this question, but I think that's one of the most interesting questions here. So whether there are non-integrable theories with that kind of UV behavior, but that kind, I don't even know what is a good way to characterize it.
Is this the same thing as asymptotic safety?
Well, no, I think not, because asymptotic safety, I think what people have in mind that you have theory which is naively non-renormalizable, but then somehow miraculously it goes into strong coupling and it becomes like there is a non-trivial fixed point. And like, well, that's what Raphael talked before last time. So let me write another S matrix for you, which would be this one. So it's again, it's S matrix for massless series in, so it's a massless theory in two dimension. And it turns out that this S matrix describes the following. Describes, so if you consider a single fermion in two dimensions, which non-linearized supersymmetry. So this is not, naively it's non-renormalizable theory because there are some psi to the four couplings there. But it turns out there is a way to UV complete this theory, and this is the exact S matrix for this theory. So that would be example of asymptotic safety, because this kind of S matrix is correspond to RG flow between three critical Ising model and Ising model in the IR. And Ising model is the same, it's just a fancy way to call free fermion. So this would be example of asymptotic safety. So
this would have off-shell observable.
Yeah, but this is perfectly normal quantum field theory. It just happened to be strongly coupled in the UV, but it's not a big deal. There is a fixed point, you can calculate central charge, you know what the CFT is. So I think that corresponds to what people call asymptotic safety. So here's something more subtle going on. Let me turn back to QCD now. So let me turn back. So one property which I already told you, and that what will be crucial for what where we will be going for doing for QCD is that, and that's the consistency check that always I told you makes sense. That really you can, starting with this S matrix, you can reconstruct the finite volume spectrum. So that's not the simplest way to derive free theory spectrum, but it's rather amusing way. It turns out to be useful way to derive free string spectrum. So it goes under the name thermodynamic beta ansatz. So, well, for ground state, there are two basic ideas here. First, if you have two-dimensional relativistic theory, then you can look at this Euclidean partition function in two ways. So basically, it doesn't matter which direction you call time and which direction you call space, but in one channel, so if you take L to infinity here, so if L is a space direction, if L is time direction, if you look at L as a time direction, then this partition function will behave like that, where E0 is the ground state energy of your theory compactified on the circle of radius 1 over T. However, if you look at this as a thermal partition function with now with this T circle being a thermal circle, then in the same limit, this just becomes there. Exponent of the minus free energy of the theory at a finite temperature. So that's one idea. And another idea is to calculate this free energy using what's called asymptotic beta ansatz, which becomes exact in the limit when the spatial size goes to infinity. So let me say you, what happened? Let me say a few words about asymptotic beta ansatz. But really, it's modified quantization condition. So if there were no this term here, then it would be just the statement that momentum of the particles equal to 2 pi NOL, where these are particles which live in this thermal bus. But however, in the presence of interaction, in the presence of thermal bus, the quantization condition changes. So that's what asymptotic beta ansatz is. And well, for instance, for two particle states, you can derive it in the following way. So you look at the two particle wave function, which you physically may think that you have a two particle state, and you look for the amplitude. You put two detectors, and you look at the amplitude to detect like these two particles with these detectors. And then depending on the order in which you put these two detectors, so like if there is one particle moving first, for simplicity, let's consider the situation when particles have different flavors. Then you put first particle, first detector on the left, second detector on the right. So in this case, just particles freely propagate and being captured by this detector. So you get the amplitude for the process is just product of free wave function. If you change the order of the detectors, well, the particles bound to collide before you can detect them. So that gives rise to extra phase shift in the amplitude as a consequence of this collision. And so then you impose periodicity on this wave function. And when you impose this periodicity, that gives rise to a modified quantization condition for the momenta of the particles. So the physical effect which I neglected here is that particles could go around the world in the opposite direction and collide with my detectors. So that's why it's called asymptotic beta ansatz. It's not exact equation for infinite volume, but it becomes exact in the infinite volume limit. And that's exactly the limit which one is taken in thermodynamic beta ansatz, the limit L to infinity. So what will be important for us later, that know from here that in general, infinite volume, if this phase shift is positive, then momenta actually softer than 2 pi over r. And for GGRT theory, it is positive. So that already suggests that actually you may expect better than naive agreement with like perturbation theory, because actual momentum phonons, they're not 2 pi over r. They can be significantly softer than that. So that's one important consequence of this equation. If you do this, if you write this equation, then you take continuum limit corresponding to a thermal bus, then for ground state, you get expression for free energy, which is the same as finite volume Casimir energy of this form, like usual thermal integral, with this quasi-energy here coming out as a solution of this integral equation up there, which comes from deformed quantization condition. It turns out that for this simple S matrix which we have here, so usually it's rather complicated integrable equation, but here you can just solve it and exactly like analytically and reproduce the ground state energy. So that's the ground state story for using TBA language. We want to do more. We want also to find a language to construct excited states in this way. That's more subtle, and the idea is that essentially if you know the ground state is a function of large enough like extra handles, large enough parameters, and then you start analytically continuing these parameters, then when you come back and there are some like in the complex plane, there will be some branches or some branching points. So when you go around these singularities, then when you come back, you may recover the full spectrum of this series. So in particular, one may introduce chemical potentials and start analytically continuing these chemical potentials, and that way reconstruct the spectrum of excited states. So this is idea which goes back to Dore and Tateo. So in this particular case, so if we look back to these equations, so in practice, what happens, so there is in this integral over dp, there is a singularity when this exponent is equal to 1. So you can deform your contour in such a way that to go around this singularity, and that picks up for you extra states, extra contributions to these equations. And if you proceed that way, you get this set of like complicated looking set of equations for excited states, which, however, it looks a bit horrifying, but it's not that bad. So basically, you can see here, so there is asymptotic part. So this is just deformed quantization condition for the momenta, and this is the expression for the energy, plus on top of that, well, there are all these thermal-like corrections and this extra integral equation which determines quasi-energies which appear in these thermal integrals, which correspond to finite size winding corrections. And well, so then it's actually a rather simple set of equations, and actually it has exactly this. So for light cone quantized string, what's nice is that we can actually analytically solve it and exactly reproduce the full spectrum of the theory. So in spite of being looking very complicated, something well, really amenable to analytic calculation. And exactly the same looking set of equation, for instance, what derived by Teschner for Singe-Gordon theory. So it looks, it seems to be that this should be a general form, how at least in the absence of reflections, in the presence of annihilations, how excited state TBA should look like. But I don't know any like intuitive, simple argument, simple derivation why it should be the case. But we know that it works for in our case. So now the idea, what we want to do, our strategy would be like to start with this set of equations is our zero sort of starting point. This is a state equation which relates finite volume spectrum and S matrix for low energy asymptotics of our theory, and to try to incorporate corrections to the scattering amplitudes directly into this set of equations. And so ideally, one would like to do that both in asymptotic part of the beta ansatz and in the winding corrections. But well, in real world, we don't know at the moment how to do it for winding corrections. So what we do in practice, we just include corrections to the amplitude in the asymptotic part. And for winding corrections, we keep the expression for which comes just from the light cone quantized theory, just use that phase shift. One justification for doing that is that winding corrections, well, they have this thermal form, so they're suppressed by these exponents. So momenta, which appears here, they're of order 1 over r. So they're much softer than 2 pi over r, which is naive estimate for momenta in asymptotic part. Well, it's, in practice, it's somewhat softer than 2 pi over r, but still. And this is like the quantitative expression of this fact. So here I've shown this integral as a function of r for, sorry, the function of momenta for r equal like 1.5 LS, which is shorter than any R which we consider. And one can see this is really, really saturated at a rather small value of momenta. So in other words, the hope is that winding corrections are less sensitive to UV part of the amplitude than the asymptotic part of the beta ansatz. So that's the rationale why this makes sense. Well, another way to see it is, let's come back now to our plot. So let's look at just pure left-moving states. So asymptotic beta ansatz for pure left-moving states would be just to say these are free particles. So they have nothing to scatter with. So asymptotic beta ansatz just reduces for them to naive quantization condition, to say that corresponding P is 2 pi over R. Well, and what's shown here, so the dotted line here is just 2 pi over R. So these are free particle energies. And you see that winding corrections, they somehow shifted a little bit. They're really small corrections, and they go in the right direction, which, well, you expect because you incorporate part of, like, low energy theories. At low energies, the S matrix of that theory, it goes to the S matrix of light cone quantized theory. But I think, well, that's end of story for pure light moving states. So there is real no real puzzle here. The reason for this good agreement is really these data points, they more or less follow the spectrum of free theory. So I don't have much more to say about this. So let's turn to these states with left movers. So what I've shown here is, so I did now the same. I included this correction due to annihilations, which is there in relativistic theory, which is proportional to d minus 26. I included it into the asymptotic part of beta ansatz. And well, these are predictions which I got now. Well, it looks better. And actually, for blue lines, it's really good. For green line, it's not that good. But also, I understand why it's not that good. Because what happens, I have this equation P equal P plus 2 pi, oh sorry, plus, I don't remember, 2 delta is equal R 2 pi. So for scalar and pseudoscalar, the correction proportional to D minus 26, it comes with a plus sign to the phase shift. So it tends to make phonons even softer. However, for tensor state, it enters with negative sign. So the softness effect, it's not that good anymore. So really, the criterion when we expect our calculation to work on, we don't expect it to work, is how hard are the phonons which comprise the states. So I truncated the lines here, well, somewhat randomly, at PLS smaller than 1.8, which corresponds to the point where the one loop amplitude at this point is like, I think it's 1/2 of the three-level result. So really at that point, perturbation theory for S matrix starts breaking down. So we understand why for blue state, the agreement is much better for small radius, because even for very short radius, the phonons comprising the states, they still remain soft in this channel. While here, they become harder. At this point, it's really, one sees that really something odd happening with antisymmetric tensor. So now we have some confidence that we have, like, understand more or less what happens with symmetric and scalar state. So there is this coherent story to tell. This point, they were supposed to be degenerate with blue ones. And this is the state for which we have better theoretical control, because phonons comprising them are softer. So clearly, somehow, something more is going on here. Well, on the other hand, it's immediate to notice, that actually that was also noticed in the original lattice papers, well, that this state, the energy of this state is essentially independent of the length of the string. So that looks as if you just added extra mass. It's not like if you have on a string on top of goldstones, if you have extra massive particle and you add one massive particle on a string, that's what you would expect. You expect to see like ground state energy plus constant energy, which is the mass of the particle being added. So let's do that. We need to add a pseudoscalar, which couples to two goldstones, and that would be the leading coupling of a pseudoscalar on the wall sheet, which is compatible with nonlinearized Lorentz symmetry. So it couples, so this is actually this interesting quantity here. With 0, no phi, so this term would be total derivative. So it's a topological invariant, which is special to string in four dimensions, which counts the number of self-intersections of the wall sheet, because the wall sheet has two dimensions, which is half of four. So just like for like a trajectory of a particle on a plane, you can introduce topological invariant, which is the number of self-intersections of the surface in four dimensions. So this invariant, so this density, this topological density counts this number of self-intersections. And so the new state which one has to add is kind of axion coupled to this topological invariant. So now when we added this leading order Lagrangian, now we can calculate contribution of this extra state to the scattering and include that contribution into, again, asymptotic part of the beta ansatz. And there are two kind of contributions. First of all, there is resonant contribution coming from S channel. That's the reason on the first hand why we added this guy. We wanted the resonance in the scattering of two goldstones. But also in the T and U channels, in the cross channels, there are perturbative non-resonant contributions. So when you add all them together, so we added two new parameters here, the mass of the particle and this coupling, which corresponds to the width. So when you add all them together, and you like, try to find the two parameters which fit best, so you find these values. So essentially, the value of the mass is just fixed by these red points. But then by fitting width, by playing with the width, you can get these two curves, blue and green. So that looks pretty good, actually even better than I may expect. And Well, it is somewhat non-trivial because, for instance, the sign in which correction goes, it's fixed. You cannot, like by playing with these parameters, you cannot change the sign. So it looks encouraging that the spectrum really looks much better. So reverting some of this logic and just as another consistency check that all works fine, let's do the following. Let's instead of trying to find theoretically, to predict theoretically, finite volume spectrum, let's use TBA backwards. Let's just from energies which are being measured, let's deduce phase shift. And that's what lattice people actually do all the time. So when they measure finite volume spectrum and deduce finite volume scattering amplitudes from there. So let's do the same here. And what I added here, so again, these are three channels. So I added here another level, which I didn't show you before. This is the now next excited state in the pseudoscalar channel. And so if you look on these points, so this is kind of the classical shape for resonance scattering. So it like goes through pi, this phase goes through pi over 2, and then flattens out. And well, again, one sees it in the cross channels also, things go in the right direction. So that's not a big surprise. So I think this picture confirms that this was the right interpretation of what we saw. So how much time do I have? Like maybe 5 minutes? OK. So this is about this state. Well, or I can just go directly to conclusions. I have some very, let me go tell you. I think it's interesting. Because, OK, I think at this point, the interesting question to ask, is it end of the story or there are more light states there? Because, well, at the end of the day, well, this is a Volchitz theory of flux tube for glue dynamics. So one may expect to see some interesting theory living there. It would be strange if it's just one pseudoscalar. But if you look, if you look at this plot, so it looks like there are no resonances. So up to a threshold of global production. So yeah, I should say that the mass of this thing, it corresponds to 1.7 in the string units, and the threshold for global production would be 3.4. So it's roughly half of the place where the continuum spectrum starts. And so it looks like there are no more resonances up to that energy. But there could be extra states, in principle, there could be extra states which don't appear in the as resonances in the scattering of two goldstones, but which still could be there. And it's so from in particle phenomenology language, that would be kind of hidden valley. So you cannot actually have your little accelerator when you collide these goldstones, wiggles of the string, and you can access those particles directly, but you can access them through, say, decay of this resonance, if you can decay to two of them, something like that. But the way, one way, at least to get an idea how light those states could be, would be to see how they affect the Casimir energy, because we had this remarkable agreement between theory and experiment up down to very short lengths for ground state energy. So here, it's the same agreement, but zoomed in. So you see, actually, there are some points which don't quite lie on the curve. So let's do the following. Let's just add to the ground state. Let's add a contribution from Casimir energy of a free massive particle with some mass. And let's see how the curve shifts, how the line shifts. And actually, what we did, we added two particles just because we have in mind something like there is some O2 symmetry which rotates them. And that's why they cannot be, and it appears the resonances in the two phonon scattering, but it doesn't. That just change the value of the mass. And so when you do that, actually, you find that the fit goes significantly better if there are extra light states. So delta chi-squared shifts by 21 if you add one new parameter, which is the mass of this pair of particles. With the mass, actually, so something like 1.2, 1.3, 1.4 in string units. So somewhat lighter than the mass of this pseudoscalar. And that's, well, that which roughly I think, well, we can count in terms of sigma. So that's how what happens is not that the theoretical curves shift that much, but this data, the way they're shown on the plot, because the units here, on the horizontal axis, I measure distance and energy in string units, and string tension itself determined from the fit. So the points get shifted somewhat, and well, it's roughly 4 sigma or something. But it really remains to be seen whether it's really due to some new physics, like this new particle, so there is some systematics related to lattice or something like that. But just for comparison, one can try to improve the feed by adding like 1^7 correction to ground state energy with some coefficient, and one would find that one need the feed gets also like there is a value of the corresponding coefficient which improves the feed more or less at the same level, but it requires a coefficient there roughly 10 times larger than what you have in the expansion of light cone ground state energy. So really, you need a large effect to fix this. So I'm coming to my conclusions. So even though flux tubes studied on the lattice are not very long and not in the regime where conventional effective field theory expansion works, I think there is a consistent framework to talk about those energy and to discuss really what we see. So there is more to be understood about this pseudoscalar state, but in general, I think there are good chances that we'll, like, with existing lattice data, this level of lattice simulations, if you use this framework to talk about the states, then you can really figure out what is the theory, what is there on the bullshit of the QCD flux tube below the spectrum of global production is like on a one year time scale or something like that. On theoretical side, it would be good, and I think it's very interesting to think how to consistently also include these perturbative corrections, not just in the asymptotic part of beta and zats, but also in their windings. Well, in principle, this technique is not unique to closed strings. One can also apply the same for open strings. Then one need to take care about like extra boundary terms, which may be there. But if one does that, there is a hope that actually this may also be useful to explain, I don't know, spectrum of some mesons with large momenta when you have long enough string between them. So real 4D data versus just this complexified theory. OK, thank you.
Well, yes, it should
have some geometric interpretation like that, but it's not just thickness. Yes, that's what you would naively expect. You expect something like Liouville mode, which is really thickness of the string, and this is some anisotropic thickness because it's pseudoscalar. It's something. It's more like some twist or something like that. But maybe, well, you know, that's one of the surprises that we don't see. Like if somebody asked me what I would expect to see, I would expect to see the scalar resonance corresponding to the thickness, which would correspond to Liouville mode. But I think it's pretty clear that there is no such a state here.
Yeah. How would the lattice data would depend on n if you take n to be larger?
So there is late lattice data for like SU5, I think, maybe even SU6. And this resonance is there with the same mass. So it's already there in large n. So
is the effective description in terms of two-dimensional strings become better at large n?
No, because this is really Goldstone theorem. So I mean, this description is just it makes use of nonlinearized Lorentz symmetry. So it's not So we have this is the same story comes through, and this resonance it is a large n effect. So it is exactly comes with the same mass in string units. In the SU5, I think it's for the SU5, maybe SU6. I don't remember, but it is there.
Can you imagine even taking into account splitting?
Splitting due to what?
You emit the global and absorb it.
Well, but here, as soon as you're below the threshold of global production, those corrections are not there. So, yeah, actually, in lattice community for a while, there was perception that this effective field theory string theory applies only for large n strings when, like, you have weak coupling in terms of like JS is small. That's what corresponds to 1/n. But that's not the case. As soon as you have long string and you're below the threshold of global production, this framework always applies.
No more questions? That's next stack right here.